This is Terry Tallis, recorded by Chris Alden Lee on the 28th of October, 2011. Terry Tallis.
The name is Terry Tallis, and I was born in Leamington Spa on the 13th of June, 1939.
So you're now... How old?
72.
Yes. Yeah. Some kids struggle with that question.
Yes. Yes, I can understand it too. I mean, I have to sometimes think as well.
Yeah. Education? What sort of education do you have? Do you go to university?
I went, yes. My education really, I suppose, was, well, my didn't really start in Australia, but I went to school in Australia for a while because we actually emigrated, you know, with those in the end of the 1949-1950.
£10
after
pom.
The war. That's right, £10 pom, yes. Yeah. We didn't stay in Australia very long, only probably just under 2 years. And then my father worked for Lockheed's, and I latterly worked for Lockheed's as well, but he then came back to the UK after Lockheed's had started in Sydney in Australia. But then we came back, and although we lived in Leamington, and the main factory was, of course, in Leamington Spa, Lockheed's in those days, they started a very large factory in just outside Liverpool. So we moved to Liverpool in about 1951, I guess, something like that. And I went to school there, obviously, and also went to college and did a sandwich course. And when I was working for Lockheed's, I did a 7 years apprenticeship, engineering apprenticeship. Hence my diesel electric mechanics experiences, which got me down to the Antarctic.
What was your first brush with the Antarctic? When did you first become aware such a place existed?
It really became fairly obvious at school, I think, because I think I did some projects on polar exploration, and I think I got very interested in the Great Britain, which, of course, was in the Falkland Islands at that time.
You did a school project on it?
Yes, yes, yeah.
Why?
So that's how it all... Why, I don't know, really, in those days, I suppose. It's something that attracted me. I just missed national service. Well, I actually had... I was going to go into the Navy, but it all stopped within about 6 months of me having to go, because I wanted to go into the Navy. And I'd... because lived in Liverpool at the time... you know, I used to spend quite a lot of time at that time. They had a fleet based in Liverpool, which was all part of the Cod War, if you will obviously remember the Cod Wars. So I was very keen on going in the Navy, and I had a great friend who was also, he would have also gone in the Navy as well. So that was my interest then started, I think, on polar and Antarctic interests.
Had you had an outdoors streak in you?
Yes, I did, because right from the very early days, I'd been in scouting. I had run, in fact, a scout troop in Liverpool with a lot of climbing friends, because at university we tended to spend a lot of time in North Wales. So we did a lot of outdoor work, did a lot of climbing, and also was one of the first instructors at the Scout mountain centre in North Wales, in the Ogwen Valley. So right, going back to a good few years before I went down to the Antarctic. So that's really got me into outdoors. And I did a lot of skiing in Norway as well with the Scouts.
And you went to see the Fram?
Yes, did, yes.
Which I've seen as well.
Yes, which was fascinating. I've never been back since, and I keep thinking I really must go back.
It hasn't changed.
It hasn't changed, I'm sure, no. But that was very interesting. You know, I was very, very interested in Amundsen's journeys as well. I've got such a very large polar library as well.
So all this was kind of building up then to the possibility of going there yourself?
It was, yes, and what triggered it, I'd finished my 7 year engineering apprenticeship at Lockheed's. My father still worked for Lockheed's and was a senior engineer there. And he said, well, what are you going to do now? And I said, I don't really know. He said, well, I don't think you should stop here. I think you should go and get more experience somewhere else. And then I think it must have been very shortly after I finished my apprenticeship. I would have been 21 still probably at the time. There was an advertisement in the Daily Telegraph for FIDS, In fact, it was the Crown agents at the time, of course, and I think I applied for it tongue in cheek. I think for it, because it was for a diesel electric mechanic. I mean, I was an engineer, and I was always pulling. You know, I had a Land Rover and other cars, and I was always taking them to pieces. And I knew quite a bit about engineering. You know, my father was an engineer. We had an engineering shed at home where we had a lathe and things in it. So, you know, I was always tinkering with things. I think somebody, if I remember rightly, that somebody had actually been injured or hurt at Deception, and I think it, you know, they had to get somebody down there fairly quickly. So, you know, that they wanted. I don't think there was a great deal of notice about it, because I remember going home after applying for the job and saying to my dad, "Well, I've applied for this job in the." The South Shetlands, and I think my mother said, "Oh, you know, the islands off Scotland are lovely, and you're not that far from home."
It seems to be a universal mother's rule that all these places aren't that far away.
That's right. Yeah. Yes, yeah. Yes.
So were you kind of fast tracked then, or did you have to go through the interview process?
I did go through the interview process with Bill Sloman at the time, and I met John Green and other people then, of course, down in London. It was. Of course, it was, you know, in the offices in London at the time.
Do you remember that as being a fairly rigorous interview?
I can remember it. I didn't think it was fairly rigorous at the time, but perhaps it was. I think what I can remember more or less, because I'd actually been skiing in Norway not long before, and I'd twisted, or not actually broken my legs, but I had a really nasty fall skiing. And I think I was limping a bit, because I can remember being sent to a doctor in London. For a medical, and he said, "Oh, there's obviously something wrong with your knees. Will you bend down?" And I thought, "Oh, I'm going to have great difficulty doing this. You know, will you kneel, crouch down?" And I remember him putting his hands on my shoulders and actually pushing me down, and both my knees creaked and cracked. But after that, I was fine.
All right, so he cured you,
more or less. Yeah, I don't know what he did, but he certainly did. You know, I could certainly, I was certainly a lot more manoeuvrable after that.
So you're unusual in that you got on the ship on the Shackleton.
On the Shackleton, yes.
Knowing where you were going and what you were going to do.
Yes, I did. Yes, yeah. Because I'd already, before getting on the ship, I'd been to Dursley in Gloucestershire, two listers, in fact.
On your first trip.
On my first trip before going down.
And why were you sent to listers?
Because of the lister engines, of course, they had at Deception, and at that time a lot of the other bases as well. But
so you're being trained upon those particular
engines?
Yes,
on those particular engines, because I ended up with a huge, great pile. In fact, I've only got rid of them in the last year or so of all the lister maintenance service manuals, which, of course, are sought after by lots of people on eBay.
So when you went to listers, were you the only FID going there?
I think I was, yes, because I remember staying in Dursley, in bed and breakfast there, and I think I was the only person on that particular course,
Okay. Tell me about the trip south with Captain Turnbull.
Well, it was an excellent trip, really. I was only recently been reading my diaries for the first time for 50 years, and I think, you know, we soon settled in on the Shackleton. Mm. It was a good, you know, good... A really good experience going down into Montevideo and then on from there.
Anybody particular on the boat? Ben Hodges.
Ben Hodges, yes. Mick Cousins. Who else? There's probably lots of other people that the name, I'm sure, is there. I remember crossing the line, which was a wonderful ceremony as well. I'm not sure if Abe Lincoln wasn't also on the boat at the time. I think he possibly was. Bob Bond was on Deception at the time. He was obviously one of the pilots. Abe Lincoln, of course, has also passed away now, and he was on the ship going down as well.
Has Bob passed away?
No, Bob hasn't. No,
he lives in Church Stretton.
He does, yeah. Abe Lincoln did, of course. Oh. I don't know whether he... I don't think he went back to New Zealand, because he was a New Zealander, of course. Ricky Chin, of course, was of course the BL going down. Who
tell me about Ricky's style.
Ricky's style. Well, he was a great boating man, and because we'd both done a fair bit of boating and sailing, so obviously we had quite a lot in common. And I knew Ricky for a long time, even after we came back from the Antarctic, because I think he was involved. There used to be groups of prospective. FIDs coming out to the Peak District for training and things, and we used to bump into them. Yeah.
Still
so good. I liked Rick very much. We got on extremely well together, yeah.
And did we have much to do with Captain Turnbull?
Yes, we did, yeah. I mean, I liked him, Frosty, yeah. Liked him very much, and I thought he was a good captain. I'm trying to think who the first mate was at the time. I think it was... I can't remember his name, but also we got on very well with the crew, indeed. But
paint me, if you will, a little thumbnail sketch of what you saw when he went through the bellows at Deception. What was the base like in 62?
It was, I think, going through the bellows, seeing the lighthouse, seeing the old whaler that was beached, which was on the rocks, which was still there, of course, in those days. I've no idea whether there's any remains of it. I rather doubt it now. Quite a formidable place, really.
Why that? Why so?
Well, I think perhaps because you didn't expect what you're going to see going through the bellows, because obviously we knew it was a volcanic island, and we'd obviously looked at it on maps. But the bellows were fairly narrow, really, when you were going into the bay, into Whaler's Bay. Yeah. So formidable because it was volcanic, I think. And I don't think there was a great deal of ice when we went in. But it was fascinating, really. I can remember seeing my first icebergs on the way to South Georgia, of course, as well. I think that was probably much more exciting, yeah.
Was Deception steaming?
The fumaroles were. Yeah, they were, yes. I had a great friend who followed me down to the Antarctic, Phil Myers, who, of course, was on Deception when it finally blew its top and they were picked up by the Chileans by helicopter. I'm not sure whether I was down at Stonington at that time, actually, when that happened. Yeah.
Did you sense in 62 that you were living on a volcano that might go off?
I think we knew when it had last been fairly active, and I think we probably talked about it, but I don't think it ever crossed anybody's minds, you know, that there was any escape drill. No, not at all, no. No, we went swimming, of course, in the hot fumaroles and things, yeah.
At that time, of course, it was the base for all the Antarctic planes, or most of them.
It was, that's right, yeah.
So I guess there was a fair amount of coming and going.
Yeah, and at that time, of course, the two Otters had never been inside. We went down to build the hangar, basically. That was one of the main jobs there, and it was one of my main jobs, obviously, to put power into the hangar as well, which was, you know, a few hundred yards away from the old base hut.
Was that a challenge?
It was a challenge, yeah.
In what
because
way?
Building anything in that kind of climate is a challenge.
Tell me the problems associated.
Well,
with
it. A lot of it was, of course, due to permafrost. You know, we were obviously having to dig footings and dig trenches for the cabling and things like that, and obviously the weather. Building something of that size to get to aircraft in was quite a challenge, because we were a bit sceptical about the design of it, because it came as a standard design. I'm not quite sure who it was. Was it Bolton Paul? I can't remember. But the doors actually ran in channels on the ground instead of being hung from girders in the ceiling, so they were clear of the ground. So they would freeze in, of course, and drift in. So we had some comments about the design of it. But it was built, and we put the aircraft into it, of course, which meant that they could be serviced properly during the winter.
And not blown away, yeah. So the runners where the doors had to go, they were actually, you had to cement those into the ground, did you?
Yes, obviously they had runners with massive great wheels, and so the weight of the doors, the hangar doors, were actually taken on these big wheels that ran into these channels on the floor, and of course they would freeze in. So it was. We used to open the doors with the blade of the tractors. The two massive. We had three Massey Ferguson tractors.
Sorry, say it again. You had to.
We had three Massey Ferguson tractors, and we used to use the blade, you know, of one of the which we used to use for clearing the doors of the snowdrifts. We used to open the doors by pushing the doors open with the tractors, because they were virtually impossible to manhandle.
You couldn't have little bonfires.
Probably not. It would have probably because obviously the doors were quite wide. I mean, there was a wide hangar, and I think the other problem was the design of it had a cutout at the top of the doors to get the aircraft tailplane in. Well, unfortunately, they hadn't measured very very well, and you couldn't get the aircraft tailplane in. You had to take that off before you could get the aircraft in.
And in terms of supplying electricity to this building, The biggest challenge was where to put the cables.
The biggest challenge was actually, I mean, it was a huge cable. You can just imagine it was a very large cable. I mean, extremely heavy, probably weighed about 7 or 8 tons because it was on a massive, great spool. And it was a very, very heavy lead-covered cable, armoured cable. So we had, obviously, to dig a trench from the main hut to the aircraft hangar to put power in. So that's quite a big job.
Was there any power loss over the length of the cable?
Well, there would have been a voltage drop, yes, but it wasn't significant to cause any problems, yeah.
You still had dogs at that time at Deception?
We did, not very many, but we did have dogs. So obviously we were still, you know, feeding them on seal. So one of the tasks was to go out and get some seal to feed the dogs.
How did you get on with the dogs? Did you do much dog work yourself?
We did. We used the dogs for going over to the penguin rookeries on the other side of the island. There was massive chinstrap, mainly chinstrap penguin rookeries on the far side. And we would sledge also up to the Chilean and the Argy base as well. Yeah. They hadn't got any dogs, so it was quite a novelty for them.
How did you get on with the South Americans?
Very well indeed, really. Very well. Probably better with the Chileans than we did the Argentinians, I think, at that time. But we got on with them extremely well, yeah, yeah. Not a problem at all. They spent a lot of time with us because, obviously, they were military personnel, and, obviously, we weren't except for the seconded pilots and the engineers for the aircraft. But we got on very well with them, yeah.
Was there a sort of sense of a different culture about the way they were run, those bases, because they were military rather than civilian?
I think there was definitely a difference, yes. Yeah, we were never sure what they were actually, whether they had a scientific program or what they were doing, or whether they were just there because they needed to be there
for political reasons.
Political reasons, yeah.
So even in 62, you were aware of the political.
We were very aware, yeah. I mean, it was during that time that Hope Bay closed at that period, and I can remember that there was an Argentinian base, or was there a base near Hope Bay? My memory gets vague on that, but I can remember either a story or it was an absolute truth that the Argy ships would come in and, you know, would actually shoot at the penguins. And I mean, they were obviously very, very strange. We of course had water at Deception. We had the wells there, and both the Chilean and Argentinian ships would come in and actually take on water for the ships there, because there were some deep, very deep water wells. And I can remember Ricky at that time, because we had to say, you know, this is crown property. You know, you've got to have permission to land, I think, at the time. And you certainly had to have permission to take out water from the wells as well.
So you were into the protest note.
We were culture at that time. Yes. Yeah. That was before it was taken over, if you like, or it changed to the British Antarctic Survey.
There was a Russian ship that came in at one point, I think.
Yeah, there was a catcher that came in.
A catcher?
Yes.
What's a catcher?
Well, it was a whale catcher.
A whaling ship?
Yeah,
okay.
A whaling ship that came in, which had, you know, a small, I don't know quite what it was. It may have been, you know, an ex-corvette, like a lot of the whaling ships were that were used from South Georgia, that Salvesons used. And it came in because the captain had been shooting shags, I think, with a 12-bore off the gangway, if you like, that goes out to the harpoon gun on the bows, and had either fallen off it. I think actually had completely fallen off it and damaged his back. And they came into the bay and anchored and asked if we had a doctor, and we didn't have a doctor, but we went out to the catcher. Because I've been reading my diary recently, which is a lot more exciting than my memory. We went out to the catcher in one of the dinghies, and I think it was Ricky and myself, and we took the Chilean doctor out as well to the catcher. Then they wanted to take the captain up to the Chilean base to, you know, to see what damage there was. They'd obviously got more equipment up there. And the catcher actually went astern and sank the dinghy that we'd actually gone out to this boat with. But we managed to haul it up on a derrick and tip the water out of it. And, you know, it was still usable, although we couldn't start the outboard, which was still on it. There were seagull outboards, but I think we rowed it ashore. But anyway, that was a short interval. And I think there was also female crew on this catcher as well. They were very grateful for the assistance we gave them anyway. Yeah.
Did you fraternise the ladies?
No, we hardly ever saw them. I don't think we even recognised them, actually, to be honest with you. Yes.
The Whistler programme was getting underway, wasn't it?
It was, yes.
I guess you were supplying power for that as well, were you?
Well, yes, but that was really done by mobile generators that they took out because, obviously, they had to put this cable across from the centre of the island to the outside of the island, and quite how it all worked, I'm not absolutely certain. But we were doing the Whistler programme for that season as well. I don't think it was very successful at all, to be honest.
Not early on, perhaps, no. What's your memories of it, though? What do you remember? Do you remember glum faces because it wasn't
glum working? Faces because it wasn't working, and lots of people listening for these whistlers that you know on the equipment that they were using to see whether this transmitter, which was supposed to be transmitting, was actually working, or the receiver was working anyway. I didn't have a great deal to do with it.
My memory of talking to other people about that is that almost the entire island was being used.
It was. They were using the island as an antenna. So and quite how this was being done, I don't know. But obviously it was to do with actually, I think it was I'm not sure whether it was a cable or whether they were stretching something between the inner, the volcano core and the external. But it was basically using the island as an antenna. Yeah.
You mentioned the cold water wells. Did you also have to find ways of generating hot water for them?
Well, we spent, I think, the whole time I was there trying to get fresh water into the base hut so that we had actually running water, which I think we latterly we did succeed in doing. But I think it was actually the year after I'd left Deception when it became really productive. But as far as hot water went, we didn't use the fume rolls at all for heating any water. There was emergency hut there. It was the old Fidassi hut, of course, which had been used, you know, before we arrived. But it was used, and of course they'd had a very serious fire at Deception in previous years as well, which had destroyed some of the old buildings.
Had you signed up for 2 years?
I signed up for 2 years.
So you knew you were staying a second year, but
I did. I didn't know where I was going, of course, at that time. And in fact, I think, again, reading my diaries recently, it changed. I was actually at one time going to go down to Halley Bay from Deception. That didn't happen. Then I was going to Adelaide. That didn't happen. And I ended up by going down to the Argentine Islands to Base F for the second year.
How was that?
It was good. I really enjoyed it. I did. I enjoyed
because?
It. Well, because we had 24-hour power there. Obviously, which was a bit more exciting. So I kept a lot busier because obviously we were restricted. It's Deception. We were having to fill diesel the oil drums for running the engines off from the diesel tanks. Argentine Islands, we had far more fuel reserves, and because of the scientific program there, which I was very interested in, the ionospheric program, I became, got much more involved in that as well. And we were running, 24-hour power. We had three engines there, not two like we did at Deception. Same engines, both Listers at that time. Yeah,
was maintaining the generators a real challenge? Were you always only just in charge, or was it all very serene?
I think because I knew something about Listers, and they're extremely hard-working, not complicated engines, to be honest with you. So I don't think they ever caused a problem. We did have some problems, of course, but we always had. I don't think at Argentine Islands, although at Deception we did have some problems because of only two engines. But at Argentine Islands, we never had a problem. And I think we had very rarely did we ever have a power breakdown. I mean, not even when you were switching engines over, because you could phase them together and then drop an engine out without anybody noticing that there was a change.
This is all down to the skill of the engineer, wasn't it?
To some extent, and the equipment, yeah.
There wasn't terribly good winter that winter for ice, was it? So I guess
it wasn't. No,
you were a bit restricted in what you could do.
We were quite restricted that year. We did a lot of boating, I think, to be honest with you. We didn't get over to the mainland at all, and we didn't get out to many of the islands either. But it was a good winter. I think that was the winter that we probably built the tide gauge and things like that. So.
Tide gauge. Sorry. What do you mean?
Well, they were measuring the
rise and fall
of the tides. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Was that something that was manufactured on site, or was it a kit that came down?
No, obviously the material came down. It was quite a difficult job to do, because we had to find a suitable place to do it. And it was all done with steel girders and things like that, and the hut built on top of it. So, it was just a challenge. It looked like a large loo, square box, sitting on top of girders, yes. And obviously the equipment was all then going down into the sea, yeah, which was measuring the rise and fall of the tides, yeah. And we had to keep the ice away from it, of course, which was a bit of a challenge, yeah.
The tidal range in the Antarctic isn't...
It isn't huge. Significant, no, it isn't, no, no.
So do you know why they were doing it?
I don't, to be honest with you. Obviously, it was all to do with some scientific program. I'm sure somebody here today would know.
there was part of the dogs who had a cat on base.
We did, yeah. We took a cat down.
You took it with you?
We took it down from Stanley, yes, yeah, yes.
Why?
Yeah. I think we took live chickens down, all kinds of things in those days. Yes, it was before the moratorium on what you couldn't take down.
How did the cat cope?
It was fine, actually. Yes, yeah, yes. I think it was just a base pet. Yes.
Did it go out much?
It did go out, not a great deal, but it did. Yes, yeah, yeah. I think it was down there for quite a while. I'm not sure whether it was there for my second year, third year in the Antarctic, or second year at Argentine Islands, of course, yeah.
Well, let's talk about that, because you came back to the UK, and you're back here for over a year, I think, weren't you?
I came back in the spring, as the ships get in.
Of 60...
And I went, of 64 it would have been, wouldn't it? Yes. And then I spent some time then looking at the new generators that were going down to the Argentine Islands, And I went up to see the actual alternators being connected and tested for the Rolls-Royce engines, of course, that went down. And that was quite exciting. I think it was Filey in Yorkshire. Spent some time in digs there, where I also met at that time, I think, the diesel mechanic. We both were there at that time, who went down to Halley Bay. Because I remember the digs there. We'd been booked into some digs. And we were shown into these digs, and the landlady took us upstairs and said, "Oh, this is your room." And we went into this room, and it was a double bed. And we looked at each other and thought, "Oh, well, you know." We were there for about a week, I think. Yeah.
So was this part of a plan, then, that you would come back, be retrained in Rolls-Royce generators, and go back again?
That's right.
So they must have offered you an extended contract or a new contract.
Yes, it was a new... Well, I don't know if it was extended. It was probably a new contract. It was a further two-year contract.
And you were did you leap at that, or was it a case of...
Yeah, I think so. I think I'd already decided that...
You got the bug.
I'd got the bug, yeah, yes. Yeah. I'd quite like to go down again, yeah.
How was it to come back for a few months knowing you were going to go again?
I don't think it was a bother at all, to be honest with you. I was fairly busy during that period, obviously, because of the... You know, there was quite a lot to do to sort out. And then the return trip was on the John Biscoe.
So you sailed down with the intention of going back to Argentine Islands, but there was some work to be done on the way south, I think.
There was, yes. Was involved in the Hyphix camp. There was a Hyphix. It was where the John Biscoe, and I think the Shackleton were involved, and the Protector was involved as well. And this is where they were doing this very accurate measurement of the sea bottom. Within metres, so we set up some triangulation points, if you like, with Hyphix equipment, so that the position of the ships could be very accurately measured. So I was with John Knoll on these camps, and Dave Matthews, and there was a couple of other people which the names. But anyway, I was with John Knoll for most of that time, and we were based in the South Orkneys, not far from Cygne, doing this work with the ships. We were there probably for nearly up to 2 months, I think. We camped. It was a camp. Yeah.
It was a better winter as far as the ice were concerned in 65.
It was a much better winter. Yes, yes. It was the Argentinian. The Argentine Islands was a much better winter. We had really good sea ice. The aircraft, when they came down from Deception, actually landed on the sea ice as well when they were heading south to Adelaide and Stonington. And we took the opportunity to be able to get out and about, which we did, of course. And we
your mountaineering skills came in handy.
Yes, that's right. With
what were you doing?
With Tony, we decided, because we Mount Lumiere, I think, I'm not quite sure about this, whether Mount Lumiere had already been climbed, I'm not sure, but Mount Peary most certainly hadn't, and we decided, because obviously the base looks at them, they're very prominent from the base, and we decided that really we ought to go and have a look at that area. And there was also, the background of it was also to see whether we could find a route over to the other coast, because that had never been found, and that would have perhaps been interesting as well. So Mount Peary, yeah.
Have you seen that photograph?
Yes. That is what my photograph, yeah.
Who's the person in the photograph?
That is me.
Oh, did you?
It is.
And where are you?
Yes, we're on the summit there of Mount Peary.
You're looking very relaxed.
I think the whole thing... The weather during that trip was absolutely perfect for what we wanted to do. We had absolutely no problems whatsoever. The sea ice was good for the crossing over to the mainland, and we climbed Peary, and then went back and climbed Lumiere, and then went off to the Petermann Islands, and we spent some time there before going back to base. So we were away, I think, more than a week or so. I've actually still got the report to confirm it, yeah. Yes, it was a good trip. Tony Bushell, myself. Who were the other two? Hopeless, really, aren't I?
Don't worry.
Anyway, yes, there were four of us.
You can keep that, but I'll just put it to one side.
Three of us climbing, and one of the lads was just looking after the base and the dogs, because obviously we took dogs over, so we couldn't leave the dogs at all anyways.
Were there any adventures with the otters? Do you have any unusual incidences with them?
Well, the otters not so much, but the beaver previously, which had also come down from Deception in previous years, had landed on water at Argentine Islands in the cove, and had hit a chunk of ice and which had hold one of the floats, and it sank. A lot of it, I think, was actually... before it sank, which it sank quite slowly, I think they managed to take I'm not sure if they actually got the engine out. I think they actually did. They got the engine off the aircraft. It sank very slowly, but that was the end of the de Havilland beavers. I think that was the last of it, which, of course, they still had in Stanley when we were there, because they were float planes there as well. But we had a big glass-bottomed box which we used to take out in the boat to take photographs of things, you know, underwater. So I think I've still got a photograph of what was left of it.
So I gather there was an otter landing on the sea ice in the area of Skua Island.
Yes.
So they were quite happy about landing on sea ice.
There were, yes, not a problem at all, yes. Mm. Yeah. Well, they landed at Stonington on the sea ice, and also... they would drop off. And
which is where you went next. Following season, you were at Stonington in 66.
Yes, that's right, yes.
As base leader,
that's right.
Was that a surprise to get that?
I'm not sure, really. It might have been a surprise at the time. Because Mick Cousins had preceded me there, who was with me at Deception, of course, as well, yeah.
Hmm. Now, of course, there was this rather tragic incident at Stonington last season when Tom Noel and John Allen...
That's right.
Died. And you were base leader?
I was the base leader, so obviously...
Can you talk me through that?
Well, I think you feel very guilty about anything like that. I mean, it was it was a very busy season. There was a lot of... The programme was fairly hectic. We hadn't had particularly good weather for, you know, the geologists and the surveyors to get out, and we needed to get depots out. So it had been a fairly hectic year. And obviously the people on base, as you do, because John was obviously the radio chap, and Tom was the diesel mech. So, and they're fairly key people, really. I was a diesel mech, so could handle that side of things, and also I had an amateur radio license as well. So I mean, I knew a fair bit about radio comms. To me, it hit me particularly badly because I'd been with John on the Hyphix camp, off Signy and things. And John and I had planned, you know, a trip, as many of us did, back through South America when we finally left. So obviously when they set off on a, you know, a fairly short holiday, if you like. I mean, that's what they were, just to give the people who were stuck on base, you know, a break from base when we were back, and it happened in June. And we just got this spell of appallingly bad weather. I mean, extremely bad weather, with extremely high winds, katabatic winds coming off the glacier. And John had my dog team, of course, because I was BL and general assistant. And Tom had one of the other dog teams. And we had never known dogs not getting back to base, even in, you know, serious conditions. Dogs will generally get back. But conditions that they were caught in obviously were extremely bad, where they dug a... They obviously couldn't get the tent up. The weather was too bad for that. They dug a snow cave and lived in that for a few days, but probably completely unaware of the conditions above them, where a lot of snow had accumulated. Had completely buried the dogs as well, that were spanned out, and obviously the dogs, you know, hadn't even tried to get away. And obviously they had realised at some time that whether they were just using the primer stoves to boil water, and obviously had realised that they had a, you know, carbon dioxide problem. And John had, presumably, John Noel had tried to dug a hole to get out of the base of the top of the cave, they'd got through, and John was found kind of just with his arms, the top of his body out of the snow cave on the top of the surface. And when they were actually found, when we went out, I'm not sure whether it was Neil who went out, it was Dick Boulding certainly went out, I think, and a couple of the others looking for them when they'd not got back to base. And I think we had only had radio communication with them for the first 2 days away, that we went out, obviously, because we realised that there must be something seriously wrong. We'd had tremendous weather at base as well, where the wind had been picking up coal bags off the coal pile outside at Stonington and blowing them around. So you can imagine what the weather was like.
Did you go on the reconnaissance trip?
I didn't go. No, I stayed at base, mainly because I was looking after both the generators and also manning the radio at the time. So I stayed there and just communicated with them. And, of course, and for the rest of the year, I had got out and sledged quite a bit prior to that, on the sea ice as well, and also up onto the Piedmont. But after that, I mean, I spent a great deal of time on base, obviously, because of communications.
So just go back slightly then. So when they were found, John was in the snow hole entrance.
He was in the snow hole entrance, yes.
And where was...
Now, if I remember right, Tom was still in the cave, if I remember right. I've got the report. I'd need to read it again to be completely correct on what happened. We also recovered their camera and their diaries, and we developed the film on base, so we knew what had happened, you know, the previous days, where they'd actually, what they'd actually been doing, you know, and building the snow cave. So it was an extremely sad accident, but I'm sure, you know, they'd done what they thought was the right thing, and it probably was. What they hadn't realised is that they hadn't got sufficient ventilation.
My memory of reading this in Ice and Men, Fuchs's version suggests that one of them was actually out of the hole completely and had gone to look at the dogs.
He may well have been. It may have been Tom that got out of the hole, and maybe I'd need to read my report, which I have the report. I wrote about it, of course.
Okay.
I'd need to read that again to be absolutely certain. Yeah,
I think.
But you may be right.
That version was that one had gone to check on the dogs and hadn't come back, and the other one was in the entrance
looking for him, trying to think of where he was. Yeah, we found they were both very close together. Anyway.
Yeah,
but when we dug the dogs out, or when the dogs were dug out, I mean they were you know, 6 feet under the surface. Yeah,
and were they still alive?
No, none of them.
The whole lot.
Yeah.
So, as a base leader, you'd be looking now to see whether there was anything you could have done or should have happened, anything that should have happened to avoid it, because of, even in those days, there was a semblance of health and safety concern.
That's right.
Was there anything?
I mean, there's nothing you could have done, because the weather when they went was reasonably fine. They had all the equipment they needed just to have a few days away from base. But nevertheless, you know, you do feel as if, you know, you know, what could you have done, really? I mean, you could have stopped them going, but that wouldn't have been a particularly sensible thing to do, and you'd have had to have a good reason for doing it anyway. I think what ultimately what happened, of course, we brought them back to base, obviously. I mean, we dug them out, brought them back. The dogs were left there, to the best of my knowledge. We brought back some of the equipment. And I think at the time that, I mean, I'd need to check on this, but I think we were asked actually to keep them. Now, that, you know, was a very difficult thing for us to do, or would have been a very difficult thing for us to do, to actually, if there was going to be a post-mortem, for instance, to keep two bodies, basically, from June until the ships appeared, you know, the following spring or whatever it had been, I think the morale on base would have been pretty low. It was pretty low anyway, to be honest with you. And we decided that, and I think we needed the parents' permission to actually, to bury them, basically, which isn't easy either. So that was done on, you know, an outcrop of rock not far from the base, where ultimately there was a cross erected, which came down on the ships later. So I think anything for that to happen on base, and it happened, you know, obviously on other bases, you know, at other times, the morale on base, on a small number of people, I think, how many would have been there at that time? 8 or 10 at the most. You have to get on with the job, but it's not easy.
Did you have to fight your corner with London?
Yes, basically, because they're in a situation where they probably think, oh, you know, we'd really like to know how they died or why they died, you know, and the only way you can do that, obviously, is to examine the body. And as far as I was concerned, it was pretty obvious what had happened. There was obviously, you know, the primuses were there, the water was there. They'd obviously had that kind of problem with them, with poisoning. Obviously they'd got out of the cave, but they were probably they realised and dug themselves out very quickly that they were in a bad way. Who knows? But anyway, we decided that we would, you know, we would have a burial ceremony.
Just, how was that actually resolved in the end? Did you simply put your foot down and say, I'm not doing what you told me to do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, we to some extent, we probably reasoned with them. Mm. Or Ted Clapp at that time was at Stanley, and I think Ted would obviously see the reasoning.
Sorry, your argument was with London or with Stanley?
Well, it was probably with both, actually, yeah. Because obviously Stanley would be asking London what to do.
Mm. How did you, as base leader, do you have any memories of trying to pick up morale? Was there anything you could do? Was it just a case of time?
I think, really, we just got on with the job. Obviously, like any situation like that, when there's some disaster, you just keep busy and get on with things, which we did. And I think the work that was done during that year wasn't affected greatly by that loss. But obviously, you know, we had some really good people on base anyway who just got on with the job.
So people didn't start having doubts about whether to go on.
No, not at all. Never crossed. I wouldn't think it crossed anybody's mind.
The circumstances were so extreme.
The circumstances were extreme, yes. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you for talking about it. I appreciate your clarity on that. Not quite the same league, but I think you had one or two rather scary experiences, didn't you? You were depot laying for East Coast trips when things started to go a little awry.
We did, yes, very often. I think sledging on sea ice is never... You're never quite at ease with sledging on sea ice, I don't think, because you never know what the weather's going to do, and it can change very quickly. And of course, there had been problems at other bases with staff and breaking up sea ice and disappearing, of course. So we were always wary about it. And I think because we were depot laying, you tend to have a base camp and then run off with a depot and a pup tent, you know, to drop the depot and then go back to your main tent. And I think a couple of times, you know, weather got really bad on the sea ice, and it was kind of, your navigation was not quite like it is today with a GPS. So it was just done with dead reckoning with a compass. And a couple of times we didn't get back actually to the base tent, and I had to put the pup tent up for the night and then set off back on dead reckoning. But we always found the actual base. no problems at all. I think it perhaps a lot of it goes back to my scouting days and using a compass and things like that.
You know. Oh, really? Some of those scouting skills did come in?
Oh, I think so, yes, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. There's an incident where you cut yourself whilst you were sealing, and that's always
pretty That's right, news. Yes.
It doesn't sound terribly serious when you say it like that. But
it doesn't really. It did need some stitching, of course. And this was with Ricky, of course, as well. And we did a good job of actually having somebody sit, scar still there, having somebody put stitches in your hand, actually, with no anaesthetic. It can be. I think we had a couple of glasses of tots of rum, I think, to help it on its way. And we did actually go out to the protector later on, which came in during the summer, and just so the doc could have a look at it and see if it was all right. And I think he said, "Well, you made a good job of that. I'll just put one more stitch in." So that was it.
There's always that worry about catching some sort of infection from seals, isn't there?
There is. Yes, I don't think. I mean, we never had colds or anything, so we never... I mean, I can't remember any illness, really, on base. I think the only problem I can think of... I don't know, Ricky Chin would like me saying this, but I don't think he went to the loo for about 3 months, I think. I think it worried him, because I can remember us having skeds with the doctor in Port Stanley, and they said, "Oh, don't worry about it. You know, the more you worry about it, the less likely you are to sort the problem out." So, but anyway... I don't think we were ever worried. I don't think there was any infections, really. I don't think we worried about infections from sealing either. Maybe they do now.
I think it's to do with the cut.
To do with the cut, yeah. I don't think we worried. We didn't. There was certainly no infection whatsoever, anyway.
Yeah. I have to ask you about a ship hitting the jetty in Stanley. What's that story?
Oh, that's right. Well, that was the Shackleton, actually. I think they'd forgotten to take off one of the... one of the mooring lines from one of the from one of the bollards on the, and we were busy setting off. I think it was a pretty windy, nasty day, and I don't think the it had been cast off sufficiently or properly, and we did quite a bit of damage to the jetty, I think, as well.
Was that on the way south or the way north?
It was on the way south, yeah.
How do you regard those 4 years in the Antarctic compared to the rest of your life?
I think that those 4 years in the Antarctic actually made the rest of what I've done during that, because I came back from the Antarctic, and I think like so many of us did, who were probably completely disoriented, not sure what you were going to do in the future. And I then decided that there's no way I was going to go back into engineering. And I think I'd become very concerned about... my life and how it affected the future, really. I was extremely concerned about the environment, and I think everything I did after that, because I came back from the Antarctic, and for the rest of my working life I've worked for national parks and been very, very involved in conservation. So I worked for the Snowdonia National Park and the Peak District National Park for 43 years.
What capacity? Always outdoors?
Always outdoors. Well, within reason outdoors. I was always part of the ranger service, was a field ranger, until ultimately you end up in an office because you become a senior ranger or a principal ranger or whatever. But nevertheless, I've always worked for national parks.
You went south in 62, you came back in 67. Britain had changed enormously.
Well, a lot of things went on, of course.
In those 4 years.
They did. It was Beatles. The Cold War as well, wasn't it? President Kennedy, I can remember, you know, exactly where we were when he was assassinated.
Where were you?
I forget which base it would have been. When was it? Was it 63? So I'd have probably still been at Deception. He was assassinated. And, of course, then there was all kinds of... world problems going on at that time.
Well, there was Cuba,
the Bay of Pigs. Right,
I mean,
right,
I know one or two FIDs who were very worried about that.
Yeah, I don't think we were worried about it. It was very interesting, of course, yes. Yeah, we used to have Calling Antarctic, where we used to be kept up with all kinds of news that was going on. Yeah.
But I was thinking about the cultural life in Britain. You've basically gone from rock and roll and Bill Haley and come back to psychedelia.
Missed the Beatles completely, because I wasn't at home during that period, and came from Liverpool, of course, as well. So that was a big sadness. And, of course, I was completely, you know, I mean, we knew the music, but I was not there from, when was it, 63, the heyday, wasn't it, really? So I missed the Beatles era completely.
So was there an adjustment that had to be made when you got back?
I think there were big adjustments when I came back, yes. Because,
such as?
Well, I think just getting back into touch with living at the time. Yeah. It became very difficult, in fact. I think you wanted to shut yourself away somewhere and you couldn't understand why everybody was rushing around and, you know, everything had to be done at a certain time and everybody was worried about money and things. Well, we hadn't had to think about things like that, had we really?
So it wasn't a case of the rest of the world speeding up, it was a case of you having not had to worry about it for 4 years.
I think it had speeded up, but we'd not kept up with it. And what we considered as important was entirely different to what was important in general life back, you know, in the UK or elsewhere in the world for that matter, yeah.
The pound in your pocket.
Yeah.
All that was going on, wasn't it?
Yes, it was, yeah. Yeah, I went to live in Snowdonia, bought a small farm and I suppose then slowly got back into the way of life, yeah.
When you were applying to the national parks, was your Antarctic experience, did it help you with your
application? I think it did, without it. I think that experience has helped me with everything, to be honest with you. In many things I've done, it's helped me considerably. Because I think you're very self-reliant. I think most people who were down there would be very self-reliant. So I think it did help, yeah. I was actually applied for two jobs. One with the Snowdonia National Park, and at that time I was supposed to be able to speak Welsh, of course, as you know, you had to be bilingual. My only profession to that was I did actually go to school in Wales during the latter end of the war, because we'd moved from Warwick and Leamington, which was close to Coventry during the Blitz, we'd moved to North Wales. And I actually went to school in North Wales. I could understand Welsh quite well, but I don't think I spoke it very well.
Did you go back through South America the last time?
We didn't. It was planned to, but because of John's death, that was actually cancelled, yes. There was John and Tony Bushell, and also Judy Sands, who was one of the girls in the office at Port Stanley at the time. We were all going to go back through South America, but that didn't happen. It didn't happen for another reason as well, because, in fact, we were thinking of doing it, but my passport had been actually renewed in Port Stanley. And the Argus would not have taken kindly to that passport. So that became, I think it was some advice we had as well.
Mm. When you got back, there's one more question about the tragedy at Stonington. Mm. Did you have any contact at all with the parents?
I did, yes. Both John's parents and his girlfriend, of course.
Have you gone to see
Penny,
them?
I went to see them, yes. And also John's parents in Scotland, in Peebles. Yeah.
So Tom and John?
Tom, yeah, I saw all the parents. What were those? And family as well, yes.
How was that experience?
The experience was difficult, obviously, because I'd actually taken personal belongings back as well. Things like that are never easy. But they were extremely good about it and extremely understanding. Perhaps they wanted to know some more detail than they'd been given, official details and things like that. But they were extremely understanding and wonderful people.
Do you remember that the official account of what happened was pretty close to what really happened? Or had were the gaps?
I think it was. I think it was pretty accurate. I think what they'd been told was pretty accurate. And I don't think we could add a great deal more to it. Perhaps we did small things, you know. Mm. I mean, we would be able to tell them more about what John and Tom had done on base. Mm. Because, I mean, John was quite a talented artist and done quite a lot of painting and things. And he'd built models and things of sledges. And, of course, I'd spent a long time with John as well. Not so much Tom, but John, yeah.
Finally, have you ever had any inkling to go back?
Oh, I think you've always had an inkling. I've always felt, though, that it would be never quite what I had imagined it, because things had changed so much. And I've never been back to the Falkland Islands, although I've had the opportunity to do that, obviously since the Falklands War. And I think that would have changed and has changed so much that it wouldn't be quite the same. And obviously how things are managed in the Antarctic now have changed so much that it would never be quite the same, I don't think.
But you still come to the reunions 40 years later?
I do, not very frequently, very often. I think the older you get, you think, well, maybe I ought to, you know, go back and spend a bit more time and meet people that I knew many years ago, yeah.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you, Terry.
It's been a pleasure telling you some of the tales.